Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, April 30th. We'll get Rebecca Traister's take now on the sexual assault allegation against Joe Biden from former staff member Tara Reid. The Washington Post is now calling on Biden to release sealed records from 1993 when Ms. Reid says the assault happened. The Post says there are no clear conclusions yet about what, if anything, happened, but they have, quote, a desire for the public to know all that's able to be known, which ought to be in everyone's interest, unquote, from the Washington Post editorial board. Ms. Reid says it happened when Biden was a senator in 1993. She says he pinned her against a wall and penetrated her with his finger. Several pieces of evidence have emerged in recent days that indicate, at very least, that Reid was making the allegation at the time. One is the words of a neighbor from the time, Linda LaCase, who says Reid told her of her claim at the time. LaCase says she plans to vote for Biden over Trump, but thinks this should still be brought into the open. Another piece of evidence is a tape purportedly of Tara Reid's mother calling into a CNN talk show at the time and appearing to refer to the charge. We'll play that clip. Biden's campaign has denied that this ever happened, but Biden has not addressed the charge personally. The New York Times headline today on the story is Democratic frustration mounts as Biden remains silent on sexual assault allegation. Rebecca Traister joins us now. She is the author of books, including Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women, and her latest, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. She's also a New York Magazine staff writer who now has an article called The Biden Trap. As the candidate faces credible sexual assault allegations, his progressive female colleagues are being offered a poison chalice. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for doing this with us. Always good to have you on.
It's great to talk to you, Brian.
We'll get into the specifics of the case, but do you want to establish your take from your article for our listeners first, that whichever woman winds up being Biden's running mate, and he's already said it would be a woman, will wind up drinking from a poison chalice? What's the poison chalice?
Well, it's this, you know, it's the kind of combination of these two threads that are happening around Biden right now. One is the building reporting on the Tara Reid allegations. And the second is this historic promise that he's made that he's going to appoint a woman. He hasn't specified which woman or even what kind of woman politically he's going to appoint. But, you know, there's not really precedent for a presumptive presidential nominee to promise in advance that he's going to appoint a woman as his running mate. And so that's a very big deal. And it's also very unusual. We've only ever had two women on major party tickets as vice presidential contenders, Geraldine Ferraro and Sarah Palin. So here's this historic spot opening up at just the moment that a case is being investigated in the press. That's an allegation of sexual assault. And of course, Biden, you know, over the past year has been accused of inappropriate by multiple women, including Tara Reid in an earlier version of her story, has been accused of inappropriate touching by women. And he has a record that has over the years come in for a lot of criticism from feminists, including me. So what's being set up is this kind of perfect storm of the women who might well be historic candidates alongside Joe Biden in 2020 being asked to answer for and to this kind of criticism of him and this extremely explosive and confusing set of allegations that have been made against him around sexual assault and harassment. And that is, it's particularly fraught. We know over the past couple of years during the hashtag MeToo movement that issues of sexual assault and systemic power abuse have loomed large for progressives, for Democrats. And these are going to be really complicated, really muddy questions. And you have this setup where it's going to be women who have nothing to do with Joe Biden's record of either legislative record or his own past actions being asked by the press to answer for them. And I think it's a nightmare.
And we'll play a clip in a minute of Stacey Abrams on CNN this week doing just that. For yourself, first, in your article, you call the charges credible. And referring to the evidence of the last few days, you write, such strong pieces of corroboration should surely imperil Biden's position at the top of the ticket, unquote. Could you elaborate on your take on the credibility and the strength of the corroborating evidence?
Yeah, so I've been obviously following the reporting on this for the weeks that it's been unfolding. And there are lots of different parts of her allegation. And at various points, I've been reading the reporting and finding different portions of Tara Reade's stories more and less credible, right? And so the first part of this is the allegation that she made that she brought complaints when she was working in 92 and 93 to Biden's staff, complaints of harassment, and that she was rebuffed and retaliated against at work. And so some of the initial reporting, including reporting done by the New York Times, which was very inconclusive, I should say, on the assault charge, actually for me wound up persuasively corroborating the claim that she had made a complaint in the office when she was working there, and that there had been some kind of professional consequence for her, because the New York Times interviewed two former interns who had worked at the same time that Reade had in 92 and 93, who both remembered, without knowing any details of what might have happened, both remembered that she was suddenly stopped from supervising them with no explanation. And that, to me, was very persuasive that something had happened that matched at least, and I want to be very specific here, the claim that she had made. She had made some kind of complaint, we don't know about what, and that there had been a resulting shift in her work responsibilities. That was persuasive to me on that front. But it wasn't until I was extremely unsure and remain unsure about, as is often the case with allegations like this, about the physical sexual assault aspect of this, which is Reade's most recent claim, and it was made in March. After it's a different version of a story she's been telling for a while, but the reporting just this week by Rich McHugh, Ronan Farrow's former producer in Business Insider, when he found the neighbor Linda Lacasse, who said that she recalls Tara Reade telling her this in the mid '90s. That's the kind of corroboration. I mean, everything, all of these cases are so hard to get to the bottom of. But as journalists, some of the things we look for are more or less contemporaneous conversations that happen, people who recall being told the same story around the same time that it happened. And that's what Linda Lacasse's recollection was for me. And I found that to be persuasive and, journalistically speaking, offer strong corroboration for Tara Reade's assault story. That doesn't mean that further reporting might not change my mind about that, right? Part of this process is talking to and hearing from as many people as possible. And sometimes we don't even wind up knowing exactly what we believe.
Here's that apparent call to CNN. That's another piece of apparent corroborating evidence by Tara Reade's mother. We are told this call is, and it's consistent with what we know, that surfaced over this past weekend. This old clip surfaced over this past weekend. The show is Larry King Live on CNN. Back at that time, in the first half of the 90s, Larry King had a panel talking about bad behavior in Washington, and they got this call from the place where Reade's mother lived, San Luis Obispo, California.
San Luis Obispo, California. Hello.
Yes, hello. I'm wondering what a staffer would do besides go to the press in Washington. My daughter has just left there after working for a prominent senator and could not get through with her problems at all. And the only thing she could have done was go to the press, and she chose not to do it out of respect for him.
Or she had a story to tell, but out of respect for the person she worked for, she didn't tell it.
That's true.
So, Rebecca, I'm curious how that newly surfaced audio from back in the day informs your understanding of this case?
Well, you know, when I heard that audio, which was, I believe, the day before Rich McHugh's reporting on The Neighbor, I actually felt two ways about it. I felt that it was very strong corroborating evidence that, in fact, the part of Reid's story that she went to Biden's staffers and complained about some kind of behavior in her telling harassment and then was rebuffed and perhaps retaliated against, that call, which is the year that she says this happened, is extremely strong corroborating evidence that that part of her story is true, maybe true. I think that that call in particular is complicated as far as the assault element of her story goes, in part because the woman who we're told is her mother says, you know, she didn't want to go to the press out of respect for the politician. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is, it's certainly absolutely not impossible by any stretch that a person who had the experience that Tara Reid says she had as far as assault would worry about the reputation of the person who had done it to her in a way that might be communicated by her mother that way. But it certainly complicates that, right? And so when I heard that call, I felt about it sort of the way I had felt about the Times reporting, which had happened about a week earlier, which was it corroborated for me that something happened that she, you know, that the version of her story that was about harassment and her complaints about it and then retaliation within the office, that story just got stronger and stronger. I don't think it led me to feel one way or another about the assault claim, which is distinct from that harassment and complaint and retaliation claim.
Got it. One of the leading potential running mates, as we've said, is Stacey Abrams. And on CNN on Tuesday, Abrams said she believes the former vice president.
So in 2018, you tweeted it was shameful that Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination was being rushed forward and survivors of violence like Christine Blasey Ford deserve to have their voices heard. Are you applying a different standard now?
Not at all. I believe then and I believe now that women deserve to be heard because too often they are not. And Tara Reid deserved to have her story listened to and investigated. What was happening to Christine Blasey Ford was that there was no investigation. There was a rush to move the conversation forward so that no investigation was conducted. And as I said, I believe that there was those allegations needed to be investigated. And I believe that the New York Times and subsequent reports support what the Biden campaign has said. And so, I believe Joe Biden.
So you said you've heard her, you've heard enough, you don't believe her, you believe Joe Biden.
No, what I'm saying is that the New York Times investigation of her allegations, the New York Times investigation does not support the accusations against the vice president.
Stacey Abrams with Don Lemon on Tuesday on CNN, Rebecca Traister from New York Magazine and author of Good and Mad and Big Girls Don't Cry, our guest. Interesting that Stacey used the New York Times article from a couple of weeks ago before this new evidence came out, though the evidence was out when she did that interview on Tuesday, used the New York Times article as definitive. You found it less than definitive. Is that response an example of the poison chalice, the position that women who might run with Joe Biden are being put in, according to your article?
It sure is. It sure is an example of the poison chalice, and it made me really sad. I mean, Stacey Abrams, who I have written about a lot in the past, she's somebody I've been covering for years, and she's a really smart and brilliant politician whose career so far has been dedicated in part to one of the most important issues of our democracy, which is protecting, expanding and protecting enfranchisement and fighting against voter suppression. And I didn't love the comments that she made yesterday, the sort of, about believing Joe Biden, and I'm listening to them and not loving them and then thinking, why am I evaluating Stacey Abrams, a politician whose work on all of these crucial issues, I believe is so important, groundbreaking, and I admire so much, and yet somehow, because she's being put in this position of having to answer in a way that Joe Biden himself so far has not been asked to answer in any equivalent interview situation, for charges that have been made against him that have nothing to do with her. And yet, her trajectory with regard to Joe Biden and the potential of her becoming vice president, which would be historic, and which is an idea that his campaign first floated, I should note, right? Stacey Abrams is somebody who's gotten a lot of press recently for campaigning, openly saying she'd like to be vice president. That's a pretty radical act in terms of women, especially black women, saying, listen, I'm prepared for this job. I'd be good at it. And I'm saying outright that I'd like it. That's not a typical move for any woman in politics to express her ambitions that way. Stacey's making a lot of really historic choices here, but it's Joe Biden's campaign that first floated her name as a potential running mate a long time ago. And what it does is it puts her in a position where she's being evaluated on questions around harassment, assault, having to do with Joe Biden and having nothing to do with her. And it is so terribly sad to me what these questions, the way that they're going to wrap in, tie in a whole bunch of women, many of them progressive women who are in politics to change the broken and abusive things about our system that for too long have been norms. And yet somehow the building of these two stories at the same time mean that they're going to be answering for stuff that they have nothing to do with.
Annette in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Annette.
Good morning. I'm retired from 30 years of indigent criminal defense at the felony level. A lot of them spent defending sexual assault allegations. And as a practitioner, I am extremely sensitive to the difference between an allegation of touching and an allegation of penetration, because when you raise the stakes to a penetration offense, then that drastically increases criminal penalties, Megan's Law, prison time, the statute of limitations disappears. It's a huge difference that gets lost.
Mm-hmm.
I think women deserve to be heard, of course. As a criminal defense attorney, I would argue very strenuously that the aggravation of the allegations from an initial touching offense, reported or not reported in 1993, to active penetration, much more serious. I think that casts considerable doubt on the truthfulness of the allegation, because I think as potential judges, potential jurors, we have, and even journalists and the public, have a right to expect that the most serious claim is going to come out initially, close to the time of reporting. And so that's why I hope that journalists become more sensitive to this distinction and the fact that it raises very severe credibility questions, in my opinion, with this woman, Ms. Reed.
All right. Thank Journalist you. Rebecca, you want to talk to defense attorney Annette?
Hi, Annette. Yeah, I'm actually married to a public defender, so I appreciate the work that you do and the perspective that you bring to this on a very personal level, as well as a professional and political one. And I agree, there's a real distinction. I mean, I think that that's part of, conversationally, I've been making that distinction between the harassment charges versus the assault charges, which are distinct. And the assault charges in Tara Reid's case are more recent. And that, that's part of what I was saying, is that it's only since McHugh's reporting that I found, journalistic corroboration that I found very persuasive on the account, on the assault angle. That said, the one thing I would push back on is the assuredness that it all would have come out at the same time in the same way, especially because this isn't actually in a legal context. I mean, Tara Reid claims, again, she claims that her mother urged her to go to the police at the time. She claims that she told her mother, this is something she told the New York Times, that she told her mother the full story, including the penetration, the physical penetration angle, which is the more serious assault charge, that she relayed all that to her mother immediately after it happened, and that her mother urged her to go to the police. She did not go to the police. So this wasn't a legal matter. this in the time that she made those claims, according to her, it was conversational with her mother. Her mother has since is dead. And so the only evidence we have from her mother is that recording that is claimed to be her mother calling into Larry King. And again, the part of the story that call would seem to confirm is that her daughter had a problem which she had complained about. It doesn't take us anywhere, and perhaps make slightly shakier by saying that, you know, she had respect for the politician in question, the assault claim. So, you know, we actually, the question of when she first spoke about the most serious aspect of this, I should say also, especially for those people who really doubt Tara Reid's claims, she's also made other statements in the years since praising her former boss, praising Biden.
One of the things cited in the New York Times article a couple of weeks ago was that Reid had retweeted as recently as 2017 praise for Biden's record fighting sexual assault.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And so that kind of thing is something that is also casting doubt on her claims. But we also know that people have really complicated ways of processing and expressing and even understanding when it comes to sexual harassment and assault, which are two distinct categories, as you rightly point out, various things that happen to them. And this is one of the things that the Me Too movement has helped to shed light on, even though that light doesn't necessarily make everything clear. There are lots of people who have experiences with more powerful people who only later understand the way that those experiences were abuses of power. I am not saying this to say that Tara Reid, that, you know, everything she's saying is unimpeachably true. What I am saying is that the questions of whether it's true or not, I don't think are easily answered based just on when and under what circumstances she made these claims.
Fox News is going very hard at this story. No one will be surprised. Mm-hmm. And one of their themes is to say there is more corroborating evidence than there was against Brett Kavanaugh in that case that Democrats, of course, were playing up as such a defining issue in a Supreme Court confirmation hearing. Do you have a take on the comparative weight of evidence?
I think it's bananas to be like the comparative weight of evidence for every one of these cases, the people involved are different, the human beings are different, the circumstances are different, the available evidence is different. And so this notion that it's an easy more or less is really flawed. When it comes to comparing human stories, I just don't think that that any kind of easy comparison makes sense. That said, the reason why journalists are doing the investigative work they do, and it may turn up evidence that makes more people believe Tara Reid, and it may turn up evidence that makes fewer people believe Tara Reid. But the reason that we're doing this, and that, or not me, I'm not doing that investigative work, I'm analyzing it, but the reason that journalists are doing those kinds of investigations is because these claims do deserve both respect and scrutiny. And that happened with Christine Blasey Ford, and it is happening with Tara Reid.
Before you go, I want to come back to the line in your article that the strength of the new corroborating evidence should imperil Biden's position at the top of the ticket. Do you want to see him resign from the race or potentially over this while the Democratic Party can still pick another nominee? Because, I mean, let's face it, if there's another shoe that drops after the convention, then it's going to be much worse.
So I don't know I don't know that I have a particular desire in this race. It's very complicated. Voters chose Joe Biden to the extent that they were able to vote. Of course, the sort of we have stopped voting in certain ways early, in part because of COVID. I'm horrified that New York elections were canceled. I hope that changes. I'm not sure what I want to see happen. It's an extremely complicated situation, but it is also true that he is the presumptive nominee at this point, and that's one of the reasons that this kind of investigation has to happen now, and not closer to November. I mean, that's, and for those who are distressed about it, and I understand why, I think it's worth keeping in mind that it is better that this stuff is investigated within an inch of its life now in I guess we're still in April by one day, then in August or September or October. Because as of now, we have not had a nominating convention. He is the presumptive nominee. I don't see any reason to think realistically that he's not going to be the nominee in November. But that said, it is better that we do this fact-finding and investigation and talking about this now, because it will go worse if it happens in October.
Rebecca Traister, author of books including Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women, and her latest, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. She's also a New York Magazine reporter who has an article now called The Biden Trap. As the candidate faces credible sexual assault allegations, his progressive female colleagues are being offered a poison chalice. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a Daily Coronavirus podcast. Under the circumstances in our country right now, we'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.